Hey, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 241, September 16th. It's a Tuesday, and it's 1 week away from something. What's it 1 week away from? Yeah, your lecture exam. Okay, ready to go. Your lecture exam is going to be on the 23rd. That's 1 week from today exactly. Chapters 1, 2, 3, and 6. 1, 2, 3, and 6. And I'm going to turn just a couple of these lights down. I did upgrade Blackboard a couple chapters over the weekend, and then just a couple more chapters this morning. So let's go see what I have there. Okay, so this is CRN 10353. I don't know which one that is. That might be today's lab. All right, and you can see I updated the supplemental instruction information. And you can see supplemental instruction information right under the button in the left-hand frame, like so. I guess maybe I'll do this for the moment. All right, so this is all current information. I will have to transfer this to the other two remaining CRNs, but I'll do that right after lecture. The other thing that I changed in weekly assignments, all right, so if we go down to weeks one and two, both of these, in this particular CRN, I updated the online practice questions for the 13th and 9th edition of Fox. So these are the questions that I like in these two editions right here. Yeah. Yeah, I would, because it's really good practice. Helps you get familiar with reading those questions. And some of these questions are, well, it says simple right here. Some of them are more simple than others, but typically these questions here, I have to stop and think about. Okay, so I'm sure you guys do too. And that's just good exercising your brain. They might be some, might be on the test, yeah. So definitely worthwhile. All right, so this is for week two. Week one is done. And then also just today, let's see if it pops open. Just this morning, I've got week three, which is two chapters, chapter six and chapter three. So chapter three and chapter six. If you go into here, now the deadlines for these quizzes probably is well past, but I just had to find some decent links. So here are the online practice questions for chapter 3, right, in the 13th and 9th edition, chapter 6, 13th and 9th edition. So these are the questions that I like only. I don't like all the questions there. All right, so that's to narrow it down a little bit. Yeah, question. Oh, I would look at both of these. Sometimes these questions are duplicates, and sometimes they're not. So if you know all the answers to these questions here, you might know quite a few questions down here as well, but not guaranteed. I didn't correlate one textbook from another. I just read a question. If I liked it, then I put it on the list for you to look at. Let's see. Yeah, 1, 2, 1, 2. 3, 4, 5. Yeah, yeah. And then you'll have a lot of familiarity with the terms and how to read a question. And nice thing about this is it gives you feedback right away too. So it'll give you a sense of how you might do on the lecture exam before you take it, not after. So that's handy as well. So these things are not study guide. I don't know what I have in the study guide. I'll have to look. I don't know if it has these questions or not. If not, the study guide is not updated. Only the web is updated to the proper questions. Okay, so that's it for the online materials as far as I know. Let's look at the schedule. I guess we looked at the schedule already. Exam 1 week from today. So what do you need for an exam? Let's make sure we got this straightened out. What do we need for an exam? You're going to walk into class with yourself plus a pencil. Yeah, make sure, might as well be a number two. Some, probably all of them work pretty well. All right, but for sure a pencil. What else? Eraser, an eraser that will erase your particular pencil, right, without smudging, because it smudges. Scantron reader cannot read it, and you're going to be missing some points as a result of that. Right? So make sure with your pencil you make a mark on a clean piece of paper and erase it with your eraser. Make sure it erases. Right? So you all know how to use a Scantron. I'm sure if you don't, then you got to practice, because I'm sure your board exams are going to be on Scantrons. And if you mark up a Scantron for a board exam wrong, then you might not pass. Got to take it again. And does anybody know how much a board exam costs to take? It's hundreds of dollars. I don't know if it's quite 500, but it's hundreds of dollars. So make sure you know how to fill out a Scantron properly. The Scantron you need is right here. It says 882E. Do not get the 882 LOVAS, right? Yeah, so you can get the 882E or the 882ES. That works fine, but not the LOVAS form. And here's some examples of good erasers. All right, so that's all important. Another thing, scientific non-graphing calculator, just like you would use in a chemistry class or, well, in some math classes they let you take a graphing calculator in, but usually not. And because you might have to do a calculation like a Nernst or pH or something like that. And then, of course, you need your picture ID. So you can never get a grade in here without your picture ID. So make sure you have your picture ID. I will just go, when you ask me 1 week from today, do I really need a picture ID because I forgot it at home? And the answer is yes, you really need a picture ID. Okay, all my classes require a picture ID because I teach online classes too, and that's the only way that I have any kind of sense that that student that's taken the test is actually enrolled in the class, right? So make sure you bring a picture ID. So I treat all my students the same way. Any questions on the schedule and what to bring for the test?
How many questions?
You know, I think I bumped it up to 100 questions, and that way it's easier for me to grade. I don't have to sit there with a calculator and calculate, like, if you got 87 questions out of right out of 90, then I don't have to calculate a percentage, right? So it's faster. So you get the grades in the afternoon. You can look at your Scantron right after lecture or right after the exam. You can come up to my office and you can look at the exam booklet and your Scantron and see exactly what you got right, got wrong, and talk to me about questions, things like that. And then probably that evening I'll have the grades in Blackboard too, which is not too hard to do. Okay, another question at all? Another question? So, yeah, the exam, the type of questions, right, could be true-false. Not too many of those. You have a lot of good examples of true-false online. But sometimes they do put true-false, especially maybe at the bottom of the page where I only have room for a little short question so that I can get a question in there without wasting paper. So there are some. Then there's multiple choice. Multiple choice where you select the one best answer. Multiple choice where you might be able to check more than one correct answer. All right, so it's like a multiple choice. And in order to get that question right, you gotta not answer any of the ones that shouldn't be answered and answer all the ones that are correct. And that will say on the test. It's called choose all that apply. So if there's three that are correct and you only get two, then you get zero on that question. Don't get two-thirds of a point for that, because the Scantron just says it's right or not right with that. Those are hard questions, I know. There's not too many of them, but those kinds of questions are on board exams. So I want you to practice a little bit so you don't completely freak out on a board exam when you go take it. All right, so just have to pay attention to that matching. So I do have exam figures. Might be the structure of a chemical that you have to be able to recognize, whether it's a monosaccharide, whether it's an amino acid, carboxyl group. What's a really fancy molecule that y'all, we're going to look at it today. As a matter of fact, I see it on the screen right here. It's a special kind of lipid. Yeah, phospholipid or lipid protein. Lipid proteins are up over here, but I'm just thinking of these phospholipids. So you should understand the molecules that make up a phospholipid, right? It's just a modified triglyceride where at one position, instead of having a fatty acid, you have that nitrogen and phosphorus group on there, which makes it a hydrophilic region. That's why it's pointing into the extracellular space and intracellular space. And then these little legs represent fatty acids. So these are this is the nonpolar region of a membrane. Okay, that's it for the test. 100 questions, so I can grade it easy. Don't need a calculator. Scantron will just do that for me. Okay. No essay. So matching maybe for exam figures, true, false, multiple choice, multiple choice. And there might be other kinds of matching besides the exam figures. So the exam figures, you will have a word bank, yeah, so that you can put it on a Scantron. It's not like a practicum in anatomy. where there's no word bank. Okay, that's it. All right, so I have no idea where we left off last time, but I'm sure we got into chapter 3. All right, so here's chapter 3. I think this is a good place to start. We're talking about organelles, and I turned some lights down already. Sounds good. Let's do this. And if you have a question about Blackboard, you can always email me sometime. One good thing that you shouldn't do is you shouldn't email me Thursday night, like around 8 o'clock in the evening or 9 o'clock in the evening, saying you're having a problem with the quiz that's due at 11, right? Because I might not necessarily be looking at Blackboard at that time or my emails. So try to get those quizzes done ahead of time. And I haven't even checked Blackboard. Maybe all of you are way ahead of schedule with that. I hope so. Okay. All right, so here is a cell membrane. That's a very important organelle of this cell. And we can see that one simple way to think about a cell membrane is a phospholipid bilayer. So just think of these phospholipids. Remember, they can self-assemble themselves into layers and even bilayers like this. And the cell then modifies that bilayer by putting in some cholesterol molecules. And so that just helps solidify the membrane so that it's not so fluid. It can put in proteins that span across the membrane. So we call these integral proteins, because if we were to take this out of the membrane, it would disrupt the membrane. And some of these proteins can be antigens, it could be channels, it could be gates, it could be enzymes, can be all kinds of different things. And on one side of the cell, it could have one set of proteins, and then on the other, it will have a different set of proteins. So what could you tell me about those two sides of even just a single cell, if it has different kinds of proteins in the membrane? It will have, since they're different shapes, so that cell membrane is going to be function different on the apical surface compared to the basal surface. Right? So if you change the structure of something, you change the function. You can see that some of these molecules right here have a specific branching pattern, or you see a branching pattern. And that branching pattern is what we call an antigen, and all of your cells will have exactly that same kind of branching pattern, so that your immune system will recognize that cell as not being foreign. But even cells from your brothers and sisters will have a little bit different shaped antigen, and your immune system will be able to recognize those as being different than the ones that belong to your body, right? And then it will develop an immune response to get rid of those cells, like to kill them and lyse them. Okay. All right, so that pretty much describes the cell membrane. Just remember, it can be different. And since the basic nature is fluid, right, we can see that for bulk transport, if we want particles, or if this cell wants particles inside it, this maybe looks like a bacteria. So here is a special kind of cell that's surrounding this particular bacteria. It's going to form a chamber all the way around this particle, and then you can consider that a vesicle. And it's going to be inside the cell, and the bacteria will be inside that vesicle, and then the cell can decide what to do with that particle. Chances are it's going to fuse with a lysosome, another vesicle inside the cell. And from anatomy, does anybody remember what the function of a lysosome is? Lysosome. Anybody remember what's inside of a lysosome? The compound inside a lysosome is lysozyme, and lysozyme digests things. It breaks things down. And you should be able to tell me what kind of reaction breaks things down. Hydrolysis reaction. Yeah, so lysozyme hydrolyzes various kinds of large macromolecules and even cells like this bacteria. Okay, and then it's going to change the structure of those compounds, and it changes the function. So it would kill this bacteria. All right, let me go back to a previous slide. I see some integral proteins that span across the membrane right here. But there are also that you find only on intracellular space. See intracellular right here. And those can be taken off the membrane, right, without destroying the membrane. And so those aren't what we call integral proteins, but they're associated with the membrane. And those are the kinds of proteins that microtubules are attached to, and those microtubules can push and pull on the membrane as a result, right? And so that's what we see here. Right, the cell membrane is actually being pushed and pulled by microtubules that are connected to the cell membrane. All right, so that's important for motility. So this is a shapeshifter cell. This is a macrophage. In the blood, it starts in the blood as a monocyte, but since it's a shapeshifter, it can actually crawl out of a blood vessel. And when it does, we call it a macrophage. And macrophage just means big eater. It's just a big cell wandering around your body all over the place, looking for things that don't belong there, like bacteria, fungi, and things like that. All right, so remind me, did we talk about this slide already? Endocytosis? You're a little bit fuzzy about that. Okay, well, we're talking about, like over here, all right, phagocytosis. Do you think this requires energy or not? So if this cell were dead, could it extend its cell membrane around this particle? No, right? So if the cell was dead and this process stops, that means there's no ATP inside the cell, right? So in order for this to happen, there has to be ATP inside the cell. So what kind of process is phagocytosis? It's either going to be active or passive. So it's active, right? It requires ATP. All right? And so whenever something moves from outside to inside the cell, generally we call that endocytosis. Endocytosis is bringing something in the sense of bulk transport. If it's a particle, it's phagocytosis. And if it's just fluid, just a solution, then we call it pinocytosis. So phagocytosis, pinocytosis are all subsets of endocytosis. The counterpart to endocytosis is exocytosis. All right, so this is where something that's in a vesicle gets moved over to the cell membrane, fuses to the cell membrane, and then whatever in that vesicle is released to the extracellular space. Does not have to get across the membrane, right? It's just released by that vesicle. So sometimes we call that secretion. That's how neurotransmitters are released. And hormones are released into your body through that process of exocytosis with vesicles. There are some specializations that we see on cell membranes. For instance, cilia, flagella, and microvilli. All of these structures have microfilaments or microtubules in them, so it allows this thing to project from the surface of a cell. But the first two are fairly similar. The second one is a lot different. Let's talk about the first two. And cilia look like this. Really long, narrow, finger-like projections. They have microtubules inside them. And there'll be a whole bunch of cells all lined up, maybe lining your trachea. And the cilia can bend, and so they all sweep, and they all sweep in the same direction. Right? So that is their job. They're for sweeping. We call that motility. Right? So they're going to move something around. And in your trachea, which is your windpipe, right, there are cells that secrete mucus into the trachea, and that traps dust particles and bacteria, things like that. And since the trachea is lined with a ciliated epithelium, which way do you think those cilia sweep? All that stuff. Down or up? Down into your lungs or up into your oral cavity? Up, out of your lungs. Yeah, you don't want your lungs to fill up with garbage. And then, of course, when it's in your mouth, then what do? You just swallow it down, okay? Unless you're a baseball player. But if you're a baseball player, you still can't spit in class, right? So just swallow it down. So if I want you to remember one key point. For each of these things, for cilia, it's motility. Cells that have cilia in our body can't swim around in the environment, but some ciliated cells that are unicellular do move through their environment using cilia, but none of our cells. All of our cells are in an epithelium tightly packed together. Another kind of cell surface specialization is a flagellum, or flagella for plural, but we don't have a cell that has many of them. We have a cell that has one, and not all of us in the room have a cell that have a flagellum. All right, it's only males, and it's only the sex cell, which is a sperm, right? It has a flagellum, and in this particular case, this flagellum allows that sperm to swim around anywhere that there's a watery environment, right? As long as there's a fluid environment, that sperm is just going to keep swimming and swimming as long as it's not deactivated by maybe an acidic environment or something. So there are ways to deactivate flagella. So again, the one word that I want you to know for flagellum is motility. But in this case, it's not moving something over a surface like cilia. It's actually propelling the cell around. Right. This last one we said was something different, microvilli. Microvilli is like a tenth the size of a cilium. And a cilium is probably a tenth the size of a flagellum, or maybe smaller. So these microvilli are really, really small. And they're really hard to see even underneath a light microscope, but if you kind of know they're there and you focus really carefully, then you can see them. These are there not because they don't move around, so they don't have anything to do with motility. These are folds on the surface of a cell. What they are there for is for absorption. They make the membrane larger, and they just kind of stretch out the cell, but yet since it has all those folds, right, then the cell is the same shape, even though the surface area of that membrane increases. So microvilli increase the surface area of the membrane, and that increases absorption across that membrane, even diffusion, right? So if your membrane gets larger, then diffusion even is enhanced, the rate of diffusion. So in one dimension, probably you should think of microvilli. All right, so here are some microvilli on the surface of a cell, like this. And we could grab the cell here and grab the cell here. What it really is, the surface area of the top membrane, the apical membrane, compared to the basal membrane. Well, for sure, the basal membrane is just this length. But now what about the length of this one here? We would have to do what? We would have to make it flat, like I see right here. So then we would stretch this out, and what would we end up with? All right, so here is the dimension down here, and here is the top one. So indeed, can you see that the surface with the microvilli is a lot longer compared to the surface that does not have microvilli, right? If we flatten all these out, so that's just a way of taking something that's large and fit it into a smaller space. We're going to see that a lot. As a matter of fact, that's how our brains are. Our brains have all these convolutions. That's what gives humans intelligence and a lot of mammals intelligence. And your brain is what? Folded up so that it fits inside your head. So that's kind of a general rule for making something fit into a smaller space. Okay. For absorption, could be diffusion, could be active transport, it really doesn't matter too much. All right. Cytoplasm and organelles. Your book is slightly confusing with this topic. Sometimes they get it right, sometimes it's not quite so clear, so let's talk about stuff inside the cell. Cytoplasm, it says, is jelly-like matrix within a cell, consists of fluid-like cytosol plus organelles. Okay, and you know what? I like that definition. Cytoplasm has two components to it. It has the fluid part, and then it has the organelle part. That's what makes cytoplasm. So organelle is really part of cytoplasm, as well as the cytosol. In the cytoplasm, we have these microtubules and microfilaments that form a lattice with inside the cell. It's attached to the cell membrane, and it can push and pull the membrane. That's why some cells are columnar, some are shapeshifters, some are cuboidal, some are squamous, because this microtubule system can adjust the position of the cell membrane. Right? But it can also position various organelles inside the cell. It can push and pull on a mitochondria, for instance. Or during mitosis, a chromosome will attach itself to microtubules, and the microtubules will move the chromosomes around inside the cell during mitosis. Like, for instance, in metaphase, can anybody picture where are all the chromosomes? They're attached to microtubules, and they push and pull all these chromosomes so that, indeed, they line up all right on the equator of the cell or middle of the cell. So that's the microtubule system. It can give cell a particular shape, and it forms tracks upon which things can move around inside the cell, like those chromosomes during mitosis, and vesicles when the contents are being secreted, or other kinds of motion around inside of the cell. So I think of this lattice work right here as being like a railway system inside of a cell. Things can hop on it and get to another location, but I don't see two rails. How many rails does this railroad have, like from here to here? It just is one. And is that a strange concept? Have you ever seen a railway system which is one rail? Okay, you don't have to go very far. Disneyland has them, right? A monorail. So think of these things as like being in Disneyland, right, with a monorail taking things everywhere around inside the cell. Okay, so it makes the cytoskeleton, plus it's also important for motility. And remember, flagella and cilia have these microtubules, and the function of flagellum and cilia is motility as well. All right, so here is a really good exam figure. I want you to be able to recognize these organelles, and you should be able to tell me what the function is. So if I have a lead line pointing to this thing that kind of looks like a bean with some stuff on the inside, I want you to be able to tell me what the function of this is, and I think actually you learned that in anatomy. So this right here is a mitochondria, and its function is ATP synthesis. It does a bunch of things, but the most important one, and the reason why it's there, is to make ATP. Okay, when I look around, I see a centriole here and a centriole here. They're usually arranged so that they're perpendicular to each other. That complex is what we call a centrosome, and a centrosome coordinates all these microtubules inside the cell. And so that's the job of these, of the centrosome made up of these two centrioles. They kind of look like barrels. All right, here is the nucleus, and the nucleus has a membrane. It actually has two membranes. Inside the nucleus, you have genetic material. This is material that you pass on from one generation to the next. Yeah. So this is the blueprint on how to build your cells and your body, since your body is just made up of cells. All right, and so if this material determines the structure of all these things inside your body, guess what it is also doing? If it's determining the structure, even of all the molecules, how they're put together in your body, it's determining the function of how this cell operates, right? So the nucleus not only is the blueprint on how to build your body, but also how it functions. And so this is really important information. You don't want any of these chromosomes to be damaged. Sometimes you might see a dark spot. That's what we call the nucleolus. It makes a special kind of RNA. We're going to look at RNA a little bit later in the chapter, called ribosomal RNA. And I do see some ribosomes. I see one here, right? And I see some attached to this other membrane system. The function of a ribosome is, and this is, I don't know an exception to this rule at all, is protein synthesis. A ribosome is the workbench where a protein is made, with some instructions from other kinds of RNA. And this ribosomal RNA comes from this very active part of the nucleus that we call the nucleolus. Okay. All right. You see some pores. RNA cannot diffuse through a pore. DNA can't get out through a pore, but some small molecules can. All right. RNA has to be actively transported across this membrane. All right. So I see a nice membrane system right here. We call that rough ER. I think your book maybe calls it granular, but we can call it rough ER. Kind of reminds me of sandpaper. And this one over here, can you see that it has a different structure to it? Does not have ribosomes, so we call that smooth ER. All right? So the function of those two endoplasmic reticulums is going to be different. Here's smooth, here's rough. Rough has ribosomes, so that gives this kind of endoplasmic reticulum the ability to make proteins. This one up here has two main functions, and you should jot these down, is for making lipids or modifying lipids, like a phospholipid, for instance. So those components of a cell membrane can be made in smooth endoplasmic reticulum. And another really important function of this smooth endoplasmic reticulum has to do with calcium. Remember, is calcium at equal concentrations across the cell membrane? Okay. What about sodium? Is sodium equal across the membrane? Where is it high? It's high outside the cell, relatively low inside. Right? And what about calcium? Is calcium different across the membrane, or is it the same concentration? So you should be familiar with that. And when the cell's at rest, like sodium, there's a big difference in calcium. It's high on the outside of the cell and almost zero on the inside. So high calcium on the outside. One of the reasons why is because there are pumps on the smooth endoplasmic reticulum that can actually move calcium from low concentration to high concentration. So smooth endoplasmic reticulum is always also a storage area for calcium ions. I don't know if that's mentioned in your book or not, but it should be. Yeah, it's mentioned. Fantastic. All right, so how is it that calcium can go from low concentration to high? into the smooth endoplasmic reticulum. That's movement across a membrane, right? And if it's going from low to high, is that active or passive? Yeah, it's active. So it's going to require ATP. So there are special proteins in this membrane that actually can gobble up calcium and stuff it in this membrane system right here at the expense of an ATP molecule, which is different than this rough endoplasmic reticulum. All right, so proteins are made by rough endoplasmic reticulum, and maybe you can see that this is the formation almost of a vesicle from rough endoplasmic reticulum, and it's going to move over to something that we call a Golgi complex. All right, so Golgi complex does not have ribosomes on it. Usually when I look at a cell, I see that it doesn't form around the nucleus, but it's concave toward the cell membrane. And that vesicle then enters the Golgi apparatus right here. And the job of the Golgi apparatus is to take that protein that's made by rough endoplasmic reticulum and maybe modify it. It might join it with a sugar molecule to become a mucopolysaccharide, or maybe it will be joined together with a lipid. It will become a protein lipid kind of molecule. Or it will modify that protein somehow. So modification is the job of the Golgi complex. And then after it's modified, oh, I can see something budding off right here. Right, then that modified product is put in a vesicle, and that vesicle has two possible fates. Right, so one thing that the Golgi does is what? Modification. The second thing is that it packages that thing that is modifying into a vesicle, and that vesicle has two possible fates. One fate of this vesicle is that it can always stay inside the cell. Right? But it won't ever release the contents of that vesicle to the cytosol. So proteins made by rough endoplasmic reticulum, one fate is that it's always going to be found inside a vesicle inside the cell, won't ever be floating around in the cytosol. The second fate is that this vesicle can hop a ride on that microtubule system, find its way to the cell membrane, and then it will fuse to the cell membrane, so whatever inside this vesicle then is released into the extracellular space. And I see maybe this is it happening right here. Maybe this vesicle just moved over here, fused to the membrane. So what do we call that process? Maybe a couple different ways of talking about it. I heard exocytosis. Yeah, I like exocytosis. You could also call that secretion, right? Secretion is just kind of a special form of exocytosis. And, of course, you should remember or realize that that is an active process that requires ATP for that to happen. So what are the two fates of proteins that are made by rough ER? They're trapped inside of a vesicle, or they are secreted. You never find them floating around in the cytosol, dissolved in the cytosol. So you might be wondering, where do the proteins in the cytosol come from? They come from what we call free ribosomes that are floating around in the cytosol as well. They make a different class of proteins that stay inside the cell, and they're not bound to any kind of membrane. Okay. Go ahead, your question again? Secretion. Oh, secretion is a form of exocytosis. Is that what you're looking for? Exocytosis and secretion. Oh, proteins made by the rough ER. One is secretion, and the other stays inside of a vesicle, but not in the cytosol. So proteins made by rough ER never float around in the cytosol. They're either for secretion or they're trapped inside a vesicle. I see some other kind of vesicles on this diagram. I see one that's labeled a lysosome. And a lysosome, oh, did we talk about that? Yeah, I think we talked about that. Lysosome contains lysozyme. Lysozyme is what we call a hydrolase. It can hydrolyze various large molecules into smaller compounds. It can break them down. So a lysosome is really an intracellular, right, it's inside the cell, digestive system, because it breaks down large molecules into smaller ones. So you have a digestive system, but every cell in your body has a digestive system as well. So lysozyme is a digestive enzyme. And what would happen to this cell if this lysosome broke apart all of a sudden? If the membrane of this lysosome was disturbed, became leaky or broke, what would happen to the cell? Yeah, the inside of the cell would be hydrolyzed, right? It means it would be broken down. So this lysozyme would actually digest the interior contents of the cell. Then what would you think would happen to the cell? It would die, right? So it's important to keep these lysozymes inside of a lysosome contained very nicely by this membrane. When we get to the cardiac chapter, maybe I'll mention that, maybe not. Maybe I'll mention it right now. Okay, when somebody's having a heart attack, blood is not delivering oxygen efficiently to all parts of your body. That's an irritation to all the cells of your body, and especially the heart, because it doesn't have oxygen and it's exercising. Right? Without oxygen, without ATP, these lysosomes have a tendency to start breaking apart when somebody's having a heart attack. Right? And so, of course, that's really bad. There is a compound that we can administer to stabilize membranes, and that is cortisone. So cortisone then is given to people that are having a heart attack, which then stabilizes the lysosome so they have an easier time recovering from that event. Right? So they understand something about how we treat that particular disease process. Another kind of vesicle, I don't think I see it here, but it will look just like this lysosome. It's called a peroxisome, and a peroxisome has a different kind of chemical. It's called peroxidase. And the function of the peroxisome is to detoxify harmful chemicals that the cell produces. Right, so they're called free radicals, and that peroxidase can get rid of them because those free radicals can damage all these different parts of the cell. The third kind of vesicle is not on this slide either, but it kind of looks like this lysosome. It's called an endosome. And so you got lysosome, you got peroxisome, and endosome. And the job of endosome is to store proteins that will become part of the membrane. And glucose cannot enter the cell because glucose is very hydrophilic. Remember, the membrane is hydrophobic, so glucose can't get in. And one way glucose can get in is if there is a facilitated diffusing protein put into the membrane. And those proteins are stored in an endosome. And when there is an insulin signal, then those proteins, those transporters, move over to the cell membrane, and now they become part of the cell membrane. And the cell then can start to absorb glucose from its surroundings. All right, and so an endosome is storing all those glucose transporters until it gets a signal to put it into the membrane. And all those transporters are proteins, and it might actually take you a week to build enough proteins in order to respond to that insulin signal. But since there's an endosome with hundreds or thousands of glucose transporters, then that regulation can happen very rapidly. Right? You don't have to just wait for protein synthesis to take place. What else do I see right here? Well, I'm probably missing some things. We talked a little bit about mitochondria. So here's a mitochondria. So you see that there are two membranes. Here's the outer mitochondrial membrane, and then there's a space, and then another membrane. This is the inner mitochondrial membrane. Sometimes it's called a Christi membrane. Christi membrane. You see it in two different locations, have different kinds of proteins in the membrane, so the function is a lot different. All right, and so this mitochondria, because of the Christi membrane, has two spaces. The space inside the Christi membrane is called the matrix, and the space between these two membranes is just called the intermembrane space. And of course, they're going to have different objectives. We're going to look a lot at the biochemistry that's happening inside this mitochondria. All right, so you said that it makes ATP. It does. It can take lipids, it can take sugar, break those down, and in that process produce carbon dioxide, but also ATP, which is the necessary energy to run this cell. Now, inside this mitochondria, there is a chromosome. Can anybody tell me what a chromosome is? What's a chromosome? Anybody have an idea of chromosome? It is genetic material, right? It can be passed on from one generation to the next, right? And if you have Let's look at the cell. How do we know that this is a cell? Because you have a plasma membrane, you have cytoplasm, and you have genetic material. Those are the criteria for being a cell. Plasma membrane or cell membrane, cytoplasm, and genetic material. And let's look at this mitochondria. What does it have? It has a membrane on the outside, which looks a lot like the plasma membrane. It's got cytoplasm in this intermembranous space and the Christi, right, in the matrix inside the Christi. And it also has genetic material. All right, so what is that the definition of? A cell. So this mitochondria acts just like a cell. Okay? And that takes us to what we call the endosymbiont theory. So this is a theory well established. Everybody understands this to be true. This mitochondria, and even if you look at it, looks like a bacteria. All right? So at some time in our way distant past, I don't know how many billions of years ago, but there was a cell that looked just like this, got infected by a bacteria that looks like this mitochondria, and then they lived to learn together because they both would provide a special function for each of these that they didn't have. Right? So that's what we call symbiosis. So why is it a good thing that the cell didn't kill this bacteria when it got infected? Because what is the cell getting from this mitochondria? ATP, very valuable source of energy, right? It can convert other kinds of chemical energy into ATP, right? But since it's a symbiosis, then the mitochondria should get something in return from the cell. What does the cell give this mitochondria to where it's happy just to stay inside the cell and not want to escape? Protection, that's right, right? So not any viruses can't get in here. You have a big immune system to fight other bacteria and viruses from killing this mitochondria right here. And what else is given to this mitochondria besides protection? Okay, it's given oxygen, right? When we inhale, that oxygen goes to these mitochondria so that it can make ATP. And in that process, it produces CO2, and CO2 would be toxic to the mitochondria, but what does this mitochondria get from us? We get rid of that CO2 when we exhale, right? So the gases that it needs to survive are presented to it by the rest of the organism. So that's the endosymbiont theory of mitochondria. All right, so a cell, plasma membrane, cytoplasm, and genetic material. So that satisfies all those conditions. And a cell is the structural and functional unit of life. So if you're interested to find out if something is alive or not, what does it have to be made out of? It's got to be made out of cells, right? And remember, a cell, plasma membrane, cytoplasm, and genetic material. So you certainly can consider this mitochondria right here as like being almost another life form, but it can no longer exist without this cell, right? And as a matter of fact, our cells cannot exist without the mitochondria, because they have evolved together. They're dependent on each other. All right, so we said that this mitochondria kind of looks like what? It looks like a cell. And in particular, what kind of cell? It's a lot smaller than this other one. It looks like a bacterium, right? Because it just has a single chromosome. Now, when you have an infection like a strep throat, okay, maybe you're interested in taking what kind of medication for that streptococcus bacteria? An antibiotic, right? And that antibiotic then kills those bacteria, cures you of that infection. Every once in a while, somebody will take a tetracycline-type antibiotic or other kind of antibiotic, kills the infection they have, but it also attacks mitochondria everywhere in their body. All right? And of course, then these people are in a lot of trouble, right? Because they don't have ATP whenever they need it. So that's a serious consequence. Doesn't happen to many people, but it does happen to some. So if you just have a flu, do you want to take an antibiotic? No. Because antibiotic won't kill that virus, right? But there's also a chance that the antibiotic will do what? Could kill mitochondria that are inside your body, right? And you certainly won't be the same person afterwards, right? There's a lot of good reasons why you should not take antibiotics unless you know it's going to treat a particular infection, but that's just another reason why, okay? Because there's that very serious side effect. Okay, let me just say something about a virus since we're looking at the cell. All right, we said the cell is a structural and functional unit of life. Okay, now what about a virus? Is it alive? The first question you would have to ask yourself is it a cell? Right? And what do you need for a cell? Plasma membrane, cytoplasm, and genetic material. Well, a virus has a protein coat. It's a hard coat, not a plasma membrane. A virus does have genetic material, but it does not have cytoplasm. Right? So since a virus doesn't have plasma membrane and cytoplasm, is it alive? And the answer is no, because it's not a cell. To be alive, you have to be made out of cells. And that's why viral infections are so difficult to treat compared to bacterial infections. With a bacterial infection, you can take a drug that kills the bacteria. But for a viral infection, you can't take a drug that kills the virus because the virus is not even alive to begin with. All right, so that's why viral infections are really difficult. We've got to think of different ways of treating that kind of infection. All right, so think of these mitochondria, little guests inside all of your cells supplying ATP. As long as you give them some nutrients like glucose, fatty acids, and oxygen, they need oxygen as well. Okay, lysosomes, talked about. Oh, one thing I didn't mention, lysosomes, since they have digestive enzymes, sometimes they're involved in cell death, programmed cell death. Right, so it's important to replace cells that are rubbed off in your body. But it's just as important that certain cells die, because cells are undergoing mitosis all the time, and then you would just get bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger if some of those cells didn't die. And there are some kinds of cells that can live a long time, and they proliferate, and they just never stop growing. None of the cells ever die. And that is a tumor and can be cancer. Right, so lysosomes and lysozyme are really important for controlling growth so that there isn't excessive growth in your body or uncontrolled growth, like in the production of a tumor. Okay, and then lysosomes can recycle cell components, can break it down into building blocks. Oh, here's peroxisomes. Talked about them. Don't forget about endosomes for storing membrane proteins. So endosome is for storing. A peroxisome is for detoxification. A lysosome is for digestion. Those are some good key bullet points that you should know. All right, so here's that mitochondria we talked about. I don't see the chromosome, but there's a chromosome in there someplace. All right, ribosome. What good is a ribosome? It's the workbench for where proteins are made. And it's made from ribosomal RNA and some proteins that come together to form this globular structure with this tunnel going through the middle of it. That's going to be important. I can see, can you see like one color over here and then a lighter color right over here? All right, so these are the two main subunits that come together to make a ribosome. And we're going to see how this thing forms with another kind of RNA called messenger RNA. But this is the workbench for protein synthesis, and we're going to look at protein synthesis in just a little bit, so I want you to modify what I'm saying, and I guess I should probably tell you, right? Protein synthesis has two major steps. The major step that's happening in a ribosome is called translation. So a ribosome indeed is important for protein synthesis, but the little category of protein synthesis is translation, and there's some other things for protein synthesis we're going to look at. Rough ER, protein synthesis, you see it right here. Smooth ER for making lipids and also for storing calcium. Yeah, very important ion. Okay, Golgi complex, right? It's part of the secretory pathway where proteins are made in rough ER. They find their way into the Golgi complex because of they end up in a vesicle. That vesicle moves around, okay, with a microtubule. I'll just kind of your way just a little way like that. Okay, and then that vesicle fuses with the Golgi body or Golgi apparatus. And what happens to that protein in the Golgi? There's two things I want you to know. Modification is one, right? That protein is modified. And then the second one, after it's modified, it is packaged into a vesicle, another vesicle. So modification and packaging. And remember, that protein now is always going to be inside that vesicle. Unless it's part of the secretory pathway, then that modified protein is secreted outside the cell. That protein is never floating around in the cytosol. Right, so the two fates for rough ER proteins, inside of a vesicle, or they're secreted, maybe after they're modified. Okay, nucleus. Nucleus, you see it's a membrane-bound organelle. What we mean by that is that it just has a membrane around it. Not all organelles have a membrane around them. We saw Golgi, endoplasmic reticulum, mitochondria are all made by membranes, but things like microtubules don't have a membrane around them. They're not membrane bound. The nucleus is, and as a matter of fact, you can see that it's a double wall membrane. Inside the membrane, you have your genetic material, right, arranged in what we call chromosomes. And in our bodies, we have 46 chromosomes in a nucleus. Right? And is 46 an even number or an odd number? 46. It's even. Why is it an even number? It's an even number because you got a mom and a dad. Okay? And you get half chromosomes from your dad, half from your mom, and if you multiply any number by 2, it comes out to be an even number. Right, so half of the information comes from your mom, half from your dad. Okay, it's in here. Here is the nucleolus, and I told you what the function of nucleolus is. Can anybody remember what the function of nucleolus? Yeah, it's for making ribosomal RNA so that ribosomes can be made. And remember, we said ribosomes are necessary for translation. All right, so this DNA in here makes RNA. That RNA leaves the nucleus, but those RNA molecules are still too big to get through these nuclear pores. Only small molecules. Proteins can't move through there. DNA cannot move through these pores. RNA cannot move through either. All right, but RNA definitely leaves the nucleus when it's made and ends up maybe in the cytosol so that these ribosomes can make a protein from that. Talked about that. Gene expression. All right, this is a fun part. This is some like molecular biology. Maybe some of you have taken some molecular biology classes. This is what we call the central dogma of biology. And it has to do with the flow of information, all right, from one molecule in our body to another. So that's really what I want you to think about, information. So we have DNA, and we have RNA, and we have a protein. And we actually looked at some of these biochemicals before. Right? So protein is in a class by itself. DNA and RNA are in another class of compounds. And is there a big difference between DNA and RNA? What's the building block of DNA? It is a? Yeah, deoxyribonucleotide, but it's a nucleotide. And the building block of RNA is a? Just a ribonucleotide, but it's a nucleotide. So DNA is made from nucleotides. RNA is made from nucleotides. And that is the same language, right? So both DNA and RNA are made out of the same language, which is a nucleotide. And what is the building block of a protein? Is it a nucleotide? No, it is an amino acid. So the language of a protein is different compared to the language of DNA and RNA. Okay, so that's going to be important in our understanding. So information goes from our DNA into proteins. And can it go from a protein back into DNA? Do you see any arrows on that slide? Yeah, there's two arrows. And is it bidirectional or do they point only in one direction? Only one direction, right? So information starts in DNA and then it ends up in a protein. That information in a protein never goes back and changes your chromosomes or your DNA around. And that is probably really good because tonight when you go home and have a chicken dinner, you don't have to worry about waking up with feathers and a beak in the morning because all those proteins cannot change your genetic material because information flows the other way. All right, so how many arrows do you see? I see one here. And I see another one here. And so this describes protein synthesis. And protein synthesis then has how many major steps? 1, 2. Okay? And so let's start with this first one over here. information in DNA converted to RNA. What did we say the language of RNA and DNA is? They're basically the same. They're nucleotides, right? Okay, so this first step right here is like taking a photocopy of DNA and just making another copy of it. As a matter of fact, you might have to take a photocopy of all of the grades that you have at this college to send it to somebody that wants to employ you, or maybe you want to get to another college or university someplace. So what do you ask for at admission and records? And they'd be happy to share your record with all these people as long as you tell them to. A transcript. Right. So a transcript is just what? Did a secretary just write down everything, or what do they do? No, they just photocopy, right, your records. That is what we call transcription, making an exact copy of what you started out with. So this first arrow is what we call transcription. It's just a direct copy, just a small modification in the nucleotides that make RNA. Okay, now what about the information in DNA and RNA? Should it change? When you make a photocopy, it'd be nice if I could change all my D's to A's or something, but that doesn't happen, right? It's exactly the same. Same information is there. Where do we find DNA all the time? Where do we find DNA? In the nucleus. So this first step, which we call transcription, always has to happen in the nucleus because DNA is there. That's the only place where you find DNA. Okay. All right, then that RNA leaves the nucleus, and the only other place inside the cell is cytoplasm. That's where the second step takes place. All right, so what did we say the building block of RNA was? Nucleotide. Building block of protein is? Amino acid. Is it the same language? No, it's not the same language. What do we call that? When somebody takes information in one language, converts it into another language, that is translation. That's the second process right here. That always happens in the cytoplasm. Now, if somebody is a good translator, what about the information? Does it change? Say I'm talking in Mandarin and we need to change that to Farsi. Should the information be the same, or should the information change when you're changing the language? The information should be exactly the same. No information is lost or added, right? It's just that the language changes. RNA's language is nucleotide, protein language is amino acid, different languages, so the second arrow is what we call translation. And where does it take place? In the cytoplasm. Yeah, cytoplasm. It always takes place in the cytoplasm. Okay, so remember, information in DNA always flows from DNA into proteins, never the reverse. So DNA directs the production of proteins. Proteins don't direct the information that we have in our DNA or chromosomes. All right, so that's a pretty good slide. Here's maybe a little bit the same explanation that we just went through. Protein synthesis, okay, two-step process. First one is transcription, second one is translation. Right, transcription happens in the nucleus, translation in the cytoplasm. This is what we call the central dogma of biology in terms of this information flow. I went back to the previous slide. So dogma, what the heck does dogma mean? Probably have to look that up somewhere. But a dogma is a statement that everybody believes to be true. Right? And so when you talk about something that you believe, what does that sound like? Does that sound like science? So it sounds more like religion to me, right? So a dogma is something that you believe in and should never be challenged. But what do you know about science? An authority. Should always question, right? Should always question. So a good scientist really doesn't have much to do with dogma. They're always going to challenge these concepts. But this is a good place to start for you in terms of protein synthesis. We now know that this is not exactly true. Okay, sometimes RNA can be converted into DNA with a reverse transcriptase. Some viruses have RNA. They don't have DNA. And part of that RNA makes a protein that can change RNA back to DNA. And then there's that viral DNA inside your cell that is active. All right? But I don't really know of a case where protein information and protein goes all the way back to DNA. But this slide is good because you see protein synthesis, two steps, where it happens, the names that make sense, right? Okay. But dogma you should always question. So this, okay, is not absolute theory. Genes. So genes we find in DNA. And it's information, And that information in a gene can be used to make a protein. And we used to think that all the proteins in your body had one gene which described how to make it. So if you had 1,000 different kinds of proteins, you needed 1,000 genes to determine how to build that particular protein. Right? So just think of a gene as a length of DNA that can code for the synthesis of RNA, and that RNA then can be translated into a protein. And that information ends up in what we call a messenger RNA that's carried into the cytoplasm. It's incorporated in a ribosome, and then the ribosome translates that information into a protein. All right, so a gene. What does a gene do? It defines how to build a particular protein in your body. All right, so don't forget, gene expression, two stages for protein synthesis. We looked at this already, transcription, translation. Okay. In the nucleus, you got that dark area called the nucleolus, and that's for making ribosomal RNA. Sooner or later, we're going to talk about the different kinds of RNA, maybe on the next slide. All right, there's a difference between genome and proteome. The genome is just all the collection of genes that you have in your body. Right? And what do these genes do? They determine the structure of a particular protein, which does what? Determines the function of that particular protein. And we used to think that there was a one-to-one correspondence between the number of proteins in your body and the genes. We now know that not to be true. All right, so we said that these genes make proteins, so we could think of the universe of proteins in our body, and we call that the proteome. All the different kinds of proteins in your body is called the proteome. All the genes in your body are what we call the genome. And we used to think that the number of genes should be the number of proteins, or that the genome should be the same as the proteome, just in a different way, right? Because genome is made out of nucleotides, proteins are made out of amino acids. So let's look at some genetic material, chromatin. Okay, it's made out of DNA, and the building block of DNA I see right here is a nucleotide. I think we talked about the kinds of nucleotides in DNA. Can anybody remember what kind of nucleotides we find in DNA? Yes, deoxyribo. But what are some of the bases that are there? You got GC and AT, adenosine, right? Thymine, guanine, and cytosine. I think I talked about that, yeah, in the chemistry chapter. All right, and so here's a nucleotide, and here are the organic bases. So how many strands is DNA made out of? It's two, right? And they're twisted around each other. So DNA is always double-stranded. And here is a big, long strand. So we're looking at, like, the molecular level. These are really small, tiny structures. Can't see them with a microscope. But the chromosome itself is extremely long. And as a matter of fact, if we were to take all the DNA in your body and line it up from end to end, it would stretch out. Actually, you don't even have to stretch it. Just line it up against each other, one after another, after another, after another. It would be 250,000 miles long. That's how much information is inside your body. Does anybody have a sense of how far 250,000 miles is? It's the distance between the Earth and the Moon. So that's really large. So say you have a molecule that's large but microscopically thin. Do you think that's a strong molecule or a weak molecule? Easily broken? Yeah, it's easily broken, right? And so that genetic material has to be protected. One way it's protected is that these long filaments are wrapped around a protein. This is what we call a histone. And when it's wrapped around that histone, it becomes a nucleosome. And just that wrapping is a way of storing this big, long, filamentous fiber. As a matter of fact, if you have thread at home, how do you store thread? Is it all just one big ball someplace? No, it's wound up on a spool, right? Same kind of concept right here. So when you fold something up or coil something up, that's just a way of taking something that's really long and making it shorter. But it also protects it. And then these different nucleosomes are packed together with more coils. Right, and then there's more coils. And then even these coils are coiled upon each other, even some more. And when all this DNA is packaged very nicely and coiled up, we call that a chromosome. And you can see a chromosome underneath the light microscope. And I'm sure you've observed some mitosis taking place, and you can see those chromosomes lining up on the equator of the cell, for instance, during metaphase. All right, so we have these histones and this nucleosome. In order to use this information, in order for, what's that first step of protein synthesis called? The first step is making a photocopy, transcription, right? In order to transcribe this genetic material, it has to be unwound from all of these histones. It has to be in a nice linear sequence like that. Easy to get at with various enzymes. So when genetic material is packaged in a chromosome, it can't be used. But what's the trade-off? What's one good thing about having DNA in a chromosome? It's nice and safe. It can't be damaged. It's relatively hard to damage, and you can't lose it, right? But to use that information, you have to unwind it, okay? And now you can use it to make proteins, but what's the trade-off when you have chromatin that's in a useful form? It can be damaged because it's not protected by those histones. It's not all coiled up, right? So that's an important point. I think of this as being... This is extended chromatin when it's in this long filament, and over here it's in a condensed form, right? So you got condensed versus extended, and this is how I think about condensed versus extended chromatin. I'm going to go on a vacation, maybe on Wednesday, right after class, okay? Where should I go? Maybe I'll go to Denpasar. Where's that at? Anybody know where that is? Nobody? Oh, it's in Indonesia someplace, right? Bali. And what can you do there? Surfing, right? Okay. So I'm going to go to Denpasar. So what am I going to take? I'm going to take my sunglasses, right? Maybe a change of clothes. Maybe my scuba gear, surfboard, toothpaste, toothbrush, hair comb, right? Swimsuit. Yeah, I don't want to forget my swimsuit. All right. What else? Pair of shoes? No. Sandals? Yeah. All right. So do I get on an airplane with all that stuff in my arms like that because I need to take it over there on my vacation? Right? Would I go on an airplane with all that stuff? Surfboard sticking out over here? And the answer is no. Okay? Why don't you want to do that? Well, if you have your sunglasses, right, you could break your sunglasses or you could leave them someplace. Right? So what do you do to prevent that from happening? What do you do with all your stuff, your precious stuff? Right? You put it in a suitcase. Right? So the suitcase is what I kind of think of as condensed chromatin. When it's in a suitcase, it can't be damaged. You can't lose it. But when it's in a suitcase, can you use it? Can you use your sunglasses when they're in a suitcase? No. All right? So that's the trade-off with extended chromatin versus condensed chromatin. Extended is easily damaged, but it's useful. Condensed chromatin is not very useful, but it's in a very nice, stable, protected state. So think of all your stuff in a luggage and not inside of a luggage. Okay, your book talks about euchromatin and heterochromatin. Right? Euchromatin is part of the chromosomes that are active in transcription. This is the same thing when I say extended chromatin, euchromatin. It's very light in color. You cannot see it as a chromosome. And then they make a distinction of another kind of chromatin called heterochromatin. And it's highly condensed. Let's see if I can go back. Right here. Okay, so here's condensed chromatin, but it's not necessarily hetero. Heterochromatin is inactivated for some reason. It can never be reactivated. So it's like a dead part of the chromosome. And there are various ways to do that with just behavior, changing foods that you eat and things like that. And then if it becomes part of this chromosome, since this is genetic material, guess what? It can get passed on to your children. So that's a very interesting thing. Okay, so euchromatin is active, heterochromatin, right, is condensed, and it is permanently inactivated. So here I see some condensed chromatin, right, so I see some histones right here. So in order for transcription to take place, which is the first step in protein synthesis, what has to happen to this big ball, all these windings of chromatin? What has to happen? It's got to unwind, right? And then it becomes, okay, extended chromatin, and it can be used. So how does it go from this structure to one that's open like this so it can be used? It's a process called acetylation. Acetylation is, there's an enzyme that takes an acetyl group and puts it on different places right here, which causes a conformation change of this group of nucleosomes to where it becomes extended, right? And in this line of DNA, what do we have, right, in this filament of DNA that can make a protein? What is that little unit in this DNA that can make a protein? We call that a gene. We call that a gene, right? And in order for this gene to be transcribed, right, that's a first step, transcription, that goes DNA to RNA, there has to be a special molecule that binds to this part of the DNA molecule that will allow transcription to take place at this location or at this particular gene. So this region is called a promoter region. The thing that has to bind before transcription can take place is called a transcription factor. All right, so a transcription factor has to bind to a promoter region before transcription takes place. Some hormones are like that. Some hormones act as transcription factors. Right, so some hormones then can change what kind of protein a cell makes, which then does what for that cell? If the cell is producing different kinds of structures, then the function of that cell is going to change. So the hormone can change the function of different cells because they can act as transcription factors. Right, and then to inactivate this active form, it is deacetylated, and then it gets wound back up into these nucleosomes, and it becomes inactive once again. So acetylation and deacetylation is a way of controlling transcription, of activating or inactivating genes by this process right here. RNA synthesis. Oh, when is this class over? Got a half hour left or what? 10 minutes? Thank you. Okay. All right, so RNA synthesis, remember, that's the first step in protein synthesis. And what is that first step called? Transcription. Yeah, transcription, because it's just making a photocopy. Okay. Okay, so one gene codes for one polypeptide chain. That's what we used to think. And each gene is several thousand nucleotide pairs long. Remember, it's a double helix. That's why we say pairs right here. Okay, so there is something called polymerase. When you look at that word right here, it's kind of a loaded word. You can learn a lot just by looking at the spelling of this word, and in particular the suffix on this word. Where do you find the suffix of something? Okay, yeah, it's not the beginning of the word, it's the end of the word. So there's some letters that make up the end of the word, and somebody saw it, it's A-S-E, ace. That means something. And that means that this is an enzyme that's going to speed up the rate of a reaction. And poly means making a polymer, means taking building blocks of a large molecule and sticking them together. And that molecule is going to be RNA. So RNA polymerase builds what kind of molecule? RNA. If you want to build a DNA molecule, what do you need? You need a polymerase, but not an RNA polymerase. You need a DNA polymerase. Okay. All right, so for transcription, RNA polymerase binds to some starting area on the DNA, and to get at the information is on the inside of that double helix, so the double helix has to unzip. There are unzipperases that separate the two strands. All right, and then after transcription, they go back together again. All right, so do you think that's difficult to separate the strands? What's the kind of bond between the bases, right, in the two different strands of DNA? We looked at it a long time ago. What are the kinds of bonds that we know? What's the strongest one?
Covalent.
Would you want to use covalent bonds for stabilizing a double-stranded DNA molecule? No, because then you wouldn't be able to unzip it, right? You want to be able to unzip it and zip it back together again. What about ionic bonds? A little bit weaker, but still too strong. What's another kind of bond? It's easy to break, easy to reform once again. It's a hydrogen bond. So there are hydrogen bonds, right? So there are hydrogen bonds, okay, at all these junctions between the bases, right, in a DNA molecule. Okay, so transcription factor has to bind to a promoter region. That's what this says right here. So here is a molecule. I see that it has two strands. So is this a DNA molecule or an RNA molecule? It's got to be DNA, right? So always think DNA double-stranded. Another way I could tell this is DNA, even if I were to erase the label saying DNA right here. So don't use that. How do you know that this is DNA? It's double-stranded, but another reason. There's thymine. I see four bases, right? Adenine, thymine, cytosine, and guanine. But that thymine is specific to DNA. So if you see a strand of nucleic acid someplace, and there are no thymines in there, then it can't be DNA. It's got to be another kind of nucleic acid. All right, so here is DNA. So it unzips with a helicase, and then RNA polymerase binds to that promoter region, and it gets the building blocks, right, the RNA nucleotides, and it then aligns them in a certain order so that they're complementary to the order of nucleotides in the DNA by base pair rules. So what are the base pair rules in DNA? GC and AT will fit together, and that's it. Now what about for DNA and RNA? Well, you still got GC, right? But in RNA, you don't have any thymines. What's there instead is a uracil, okay, which is U, right? So wherever there's an adenine in the DNA molecule, you don't put a thymine in for RNA, you put a uracil, a U. All right, so this process of taking this specific order of nucleotides in DNA, right, and putting these nucleotides in a specific order that's complementary to the order in DNA into RNA, this process is what we call, for sure it's RNA synthesis, but what do we call that? That is called transcription, right, so transcription. So the order of these nucleotides is going to be exactly the same as the order of nucleotides in the DNA molecule. Just got to remember, just a couple of things have to change. All right, and the molecule or the enzyme that makes this RNA molecule is RNA polymerase. And RNA polymerase knows when to start because there's a promoter region, there's a start signal, and there's a transcription factor, and then there's a certain signal that says stop. And then that transcription process will stop. All right, so here we have RNA. So if I give you this molecule here, could you tell me if this is DNA or RNA, where I have the pointer? RNA. How could you tell me? Two reasons. Because of uracil and single strand. Okay, so you know that to be an RNA. How did we get this RNA from DNA? Process called transcription, right? Okay. All right, so there are different kind of RNAs that are produced. Basically, there are three kinds, but there's a precursor to messenger RNA. We call that pre-messenger RNA. So sometimes people think of four different kinds of RNA that are made. Let's start at the bottom. rRNA is used to make a ribosome, right? We saw a picture of that. So that's pretty easy. And you know where this happens. Where does this happen inside the nucleus? In the nucleolus, right? Okay, transfer RNA is a very interesting kind of RNA because it can base pair with other kinds of RNA, but it is also responsible for picking up an amino acid and dragging it around the cell. And what can you build with an amino acid? A protein. So transfer RNA brings amino acids into that ribosome so that the ribosome can be busy making a protein. We call that a transfer RNA. Sometimes I call it a taxi RNA because it's taxiing amino acids around throughout the cell. But don't tell anybody I told you that, right? T for transfer. All right. Messenger RNA, right, is the dictionary on how to spell a particular protein. So what amino acid goes in the first position, what goes in the second, what goes in the third, which goes in the fourth. So you could think of a protein as a word, right, and a word has a certain spelling to it. The letters have to be in a special order. What happens if you change the order of letters in a word? Is the word the same word? No. It might be meaningless, right? Or it might take on a whole different meaning altogether. Right? So this messenger RNA is, right, the dictionary on how to spell out a particular protein. We say it codes for the synthesis of a protein. And messenger RNA comes from pre-messenger RNA, and that's made by transcription in the nucleus. And it's used to make messenger RNA, right? Pre is before messenger RNA. We'll see how that happens. Maybe on the next slide. Yes, next slide. All right, so we're still talking about, what's another word for RNA synthesis? Transcription. Where does it happen? Nucleus. Okay. So here we have DNA, right? I don't see any thymines, but I don't see any uracils either, but it's double-stranded. And how do we make an RNA molecule? Transcription. So now here is the transcript of the DNA molecule, and it's really long. And if you look at this whole length of RNA, does it look the same or do you see different colors in there? Different colors. It has different segments. It has different spots. And these things are called exons and introns. Right, so this was all just one gene. It was all transcribed at the same time. But because of these different segments in there, we can make different kinds of messenger RNA from it. So what happens is that these things bend up on each other, and there's an enzyme that will clip out this section, right? We'll clip out the intron, right? And we'll clip out this one and join these two exons together and join these two exons together to where now you have just one big strand of RNA with these introns, okay, taken out of it. So the introns aren't necessary to make a protein, but the exons are. The other thing that's important is that there are some processes in the cell that take this middle segment and don't put it in the middle, but maybe put it at the end. Or maybe it gets rid of this middle segment and it joins the two side segments together to make a messenger RNA. And that's going to make another kind of protein. So we see one gene can make more than one protein, okay, depending upon how these alternate or these exons are put together. Right, they're spliced together. We call that alternate splicing. Alternate splicing is a way that we explain how one gene can actually make a number of different proteins. So the genome is not exactly the same as the proteome. The human genome has about 25,000 genes, yet the proteome is 100,000. So that means that there can't be a one-to-one correspondence. If there was, how many genes would you have to have? You would have to have 100,000 genes. Right, but since one gene can make many proteins, right, you don't have to have so many genes. We call that process alternative or alternate splicing of introns together. All right, so introns and exons are pretty important. Sign that sign-in sheet going around. Next time, we're going to start with protein synthesis. Who's got the sign-in sheet? Was it going around? I hope so. I usually forget to pass it around, but if you came in late, make sure you sign it, please.